Okay, we'll now conclude from chapter 16, verse 3, to the end of chapter 25. There were certain cities set aside as an asylum for accidental killing. And you find a different thing in Deuteronomy 19. They add another three on. And if you go back to the beginning of Deuteronomy, you'll find they've got a different number. So it obviously varied with different times. Why did they need to do it? Because one of the tribal... This is the insight I first got in regard to Greek. Homer and this kind of thing. And you get an insight and you think, oh, I never thought of it that way before. In much of the ancient world, if someone from your tribe killed my brother, let's say, or my niece or cousin or somebody in the tribe, I, as a warrior, had an absolute obligation to revenge. I had to get you and kill you for killing my brother. And that was virtuous. If I didn't do it, if I turned the other cheek, it was cowardice, failure to, it was really a vice. So you've got to look at it different ways. So in this world here, similarly, if one from one tribe did something, then the obligation, it was called the Goel, the Redeemer, the one who actually who your blood has been poured out, I must go and find the culprit and kill them. Must. In God's name, kind of thing. This is all virtue. The opposite is not virtue. Think that way and your brain does a double somersault and you have to think differently. But to avoid, because sometimes you might have killed my brother accidentally. You haven't got much time, because if I find out my brother's dead and you're living down the road, you're done, or I'm going to at least try and kill you. I might get killed myself too. But me and my mates will come down and sort it out. And so if you had an accidental killing, brackets, this still happens in some parts of Papua New Guinea and other places, no doubt. If you're driving along in the car and someone runs out in front of the car, for God's sake, don't stay and argue the point that it was an accident and that the child ran out and you're trying to help them. You're done. You're finished. You're cactus. You've got to drive away as fast as you possibly can and find a safe place to be. Then you can have your argument later. Otherwise, the quick revenge, it's part of, tribalism. Now, they had that too. So there were certain cities set aside where you could go and get asylum. So you're safe there. It would have to come to court later and there'd have to be witnesses, etc. But at least you could argue the point that it was an accident. It wasn't your fault that he fell over. You happened to be there at the time, but he had just tripped and fell in front of the horse or whatever it was. Do you get it? So that's what these asylum cities are. There's a later edition, 441 to 43, which we did on the first day. That's an introduction to the whole work. Now, in that introduction, you'll find there are another three cities in Transjordan, because there are now tribal areas over there, not because of Moses defeating Sihon, the king of the Amorites, and Og, the king of Bashan, which didn't happen because the Amorites weren't there and Bashan didn't have a king at that time of Moses. But that's in the story. I hope you can get used to these stories. Though later on, King David and others did encroach in that area in the Transjordan, and tribal areas spread over to there, much like the Jews are now spreading into the West Bank and all that dreadful stuff. So there's development going on there, and I don't want to waste time getting into it. There's a couple of, you must not move your neighbour's boundary marker. Okay, there's a fair bit of guilt in this room. You shift the fence a couple of feet because you've got a big car and you want to drive into your driveway, so you edge the garden over a little bit. Well, they weren't allowed to do that for similar reasons. False witnesses suffer a penalty that they intended for the victim. If you get up and accuse me of doing something and I might be killed because of it, and it's proven that you've lied, you get killed. You get the punishment that I would have got had you had your witness been accepted. That might make you a little bit careful. Think it would. We perhaps could introduce that too into the, when they've got nothing better to argue about in the Parliament, maybe they could get onto this. Here, 19, show no pity, you know this one. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Matthew 5:38, Jesus quotes that. It was said to you. Could be, yeah. The Quran borrowed a whole lot of stuff from the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament because it was written basically by Christians, not Christians in communion with the general church, but Christians and Jews. They were the kind of inspiration behind a lot of it. And then the mystical, whatever they were, of Muhammad, which were a complicated story. And don't want to say too much or I mightn't get home. Show no pity, life for life. This is called the lex talionis, is the Latin term it often goes under. Talis in Latin means as, such. So as is the crime, such is to be the punishment. Now, actually, it was an advance. It was a considerable advance on what was happening. Because if I, in other words, I'm a wealthy landowner and you steal one of my lambs, I go in, I just take all your flock. You're not going to stop me. No, the law says. I can only take a lamb. So it's a restricting of the power of the powerful against the poor. It looks dreadful, put as it is, but it's actually quite an advance. Not perfect, but a way of limiting the punishment has to fit the crime. Which almost reminds me of Gilbert and Sullivan. The punishment fit the crime. You know that one song. There's an attempt to put a check on the barbarity of war in chapter 20. Verses 1 to 20. You have to read it for yourself because the barbarity of war hasn't been. But from the 6th century BC onwards, so from the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, all Judah's wars were defensive against the Edomites or against the Greeks or whatever it was. You know, there was no aggressive what's the word I'm looking for? Advance of the Jewish people. So when this document is written, all law is in fact defensive. And of course you have to have defensive war if it's appropriate. So there's knowing that and reading that make a bit of sense. But since I haven't read it to you, it makes no sense. But you've got all day to read the rest of it. Certain men are exempted from having to fight in the battle. And very sensitively, if a man, for example, is just married, he's allowed to go home and work it all out and come back later. He doesn't have to go straight into battle and never having wooed this beautiful damsel with eyes like a gazelle for 2 years, he suddenly has to go and fight a battle and never... So that's pretty sensitive. And there are other people too who were allowed off battle. They must annihilate pagans within Canaan. When this is written, there are no pagans within Canaan. It's like saying in Ireland, you know, in Southern Ireland, you've got to, anyone who's not a Catholic, kill them. There aren't any. There are, you know what I mean. It's not an issue when it's written. So why is it written? It's a reminder, retrospective reminder of holding on to your faith. Don't compromise your religion. And it's the same Deuteronomic school who wrote the book of Joshua. And they have Joshua going in and killing everybody. And God saying, I want all the men, women and kids annihilated. Well, that never happened. Never happened. So it never happened in the past, I mean. Archaeology puts a pay to that. But when it was written in later times, it's saying, look what our ancestors did. They did this and God did this. So stop you compromising with the Edomites and stop worshipping ancestors and having voodoo stuff or the equivalent, you know, with blood and trying to find... No, keep your faith in Yahweh. But if you don't know that, it looks like God actually commanded it. Do you get me? It says that. So if you read the Bible without teaching and you think, well, God must have changed. It was said to you of old, love your neighbour and hate your enemy, remember? But I say to you, love your enemies. So what's happened? Has God changed? No. Has Jesus seen more perceptively God's will? Yes. Has he released us from it was said to you of old? And yet there are people who look at what it was said of old, go back to the books of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, and think we should live like that. Or they go back to Paul's statements, forgetting what marriage was like, and they set up little groups where the husband always commands and the wife always obeys. It's not a Catholic practice. Thanks be to God. And if your husband happens to be a drunk and a buffhead and has seizures in his mental capacity every day, you're going to obey him all the time? Oh, it's got to be rights to perform when a murderer can't be apprehended, because blood has been still, everything's gone awry because there's been blood. You've got to do something. So if you can't find the murderer, there have to be little sacrifices and little things to get things cleaned up again. Women taken as spoils of war must be allowed a month to mourn. That's decent. And if the owner has sex with her, she can't be sold into slavery. Oh, having sex with her, that's, of course, that's part of it. I mean, why else would you want to win a battle? So that's all their culture, pretty primitive stuff, definitely male-dominated, as you'd well imagine. But it's trying to bring in some protection, not much, some protection for the woman, who has no choice in the matter. But if he does have sex, he can't sell her into slavery, and he can't have sex with her for a month while she's mourning her husband, who's just been skewered in her presence back in the camp. We're dealing with pretty primitive stuff here. There's legislation to protect the rights of the firstborn son. A rebellious son is to be taken to the elders. If found guilty, they may order him to be stoned to death. Chapter 21, 18 to 21, I recommend you think about that. That could make things at home a lot easier for you. But it's pretty primitive, isn't it? Did it ever happen? We don't know. We're not saying that. So you've got to look at what were the values they were trying to perpetrate in this legal system? Obedience. And maybe this kind of law would tend to help a boy. But the culture is so different from ours. You can't apply it, but you've got to kind of read about it. Hanging is interesting. This is chapter 21. When someone is convicted of a crime punishable by death and is executed, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse must not remain all night upon the tree. You shall bury him that same day, for anyone hung on a tree is under God's curse. You mustn't defile the land that Yahweh your God is giving you as your possession. Linking up with Jesus' death and getting him down before the day, before the sun sets. That's the law. There's a law there in chapter 22 about caring for your neighbour's animals. It's quite modern, really, quite lovely. You can read it for yourself. The divine order is not to be confused. Here's some examples. A woman shall not wear a man's apparel, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment. Priests, eat your heart out. For whoever does such things is abhorrent to Yahweh your God. So there's their little transvestite stuff. It's been going on from the beginning. And the only people allowed to do it are we're allowed to do it. And we love it. Chapter 22, verse 9. Oh, dear. You've got to have a sense of humour, haven't you, about the life. Here's chapter 22, verse 9. You shall not sow your vineyard with a second kind of seed. Mixing seeds. There's this sense of order, nature. Women are women, men are men. Women have long hair, men have short hair. You know, all these different... We've still got caught up in some of this. It's hard to get out of it, isn't it? Some people seem to love it, and then others don't care about it. It all gets confused. So here it is. This is another thing not to get mixed up. Don't get mixed up. Men and women, they're not the same, in case you hadn't noticed. You shall not sow your vineyard with a second kind of seed, or the whole yield will have to be forfeited. Both the crop that you've sown and the yield of the vineyard itself. You have to burn it all. You shall not plough with an ox and a donkey yoked together. they're trying to see, where's that come from? You shall not wear clothes made of wool and linen woven together. Oh, thank God. I wouldn't ask you to take off anything of that kind now. Maybe a bit distinctive dress for Jews. Chapter 22, verse 12, you shall make tassels on the four corners of the cloak with which you cover yourself. So they had their distinct... didn't every nation have its own distinct dressing just about, even till quite recent times, and perhaps still they do. So it's a distinctive... But then Jesus wasn't against that, because he had tassels himself, and the woman touched one of them, who was healed last Sunday. But he was against the Pharisees, who wore longer tassels. You know, they wanted to have that to be something special. Nothing wrong with what you wear, but okay. So these are all little laws that may interest you or may not. There's a disgraceful piece of legislation. I think it's disgraceful. Protecting a man's right to be sure that he's marrying a virgin. Nothing for the woman to be sure she's marrying a virgin. This is all terribly male and terribly dreadful. Read it for yourself at home, just for fascination, to help you relativize the laws. All the laws are tribal. And if only the Muslims would do this with their Islamic law and realize how it's 8th century tribal Arabic situation. But it's from God. So at least we can interpret this stuff and see the limits of it. And so we have to. There's legislation concerning illicit sex in the rest of chapter 22. Here's a bit of a problem. No one whose testicles are crushed or whose penis is cut off shall be admitted to the assembly of Yahweh. Because you've got to be pure to come into God's presence. So, wouldn't you like to belong to a church that was pure? And if you did want to belong to it, why are you there? Do you know what I mean? There'd be nobody there if they were fair dinkum. So we're all on a journey of this, but that's so they weren't allowed in because why? Because God must have made this happen. God must be punishing them. God is just, so they must have done something. So everyone's suspicious of what they've done to bring this about. It's not only them; there are other people too weren't allowed in. Then you read, which we did, those Isaiah 56 to 4 to 5, and these are the post-exilic disciples of the exile, and they said, eunuchs, so we're talking about, can worship in my house, and foreigners can worship in my house. That's a house of prayer for all the nations. Remember that? Not just for this pure little tribal group. So there's argument in the Bible. You either believe Deuteronomy 23:1 or Isaiah 56:4-5, and you can see there's a debate going on in the middle of the Bible. Of course it's there. And then you have Jesus quoting that too. My house will be a house of prayer for all the peoples. The Catholic, all-embracing view. There's 23, legislation governing ethnic purity in the assembly. Not exactly ethnic cleansing, because we've seen other stuff. They've got to look after the residents, the alien residents in your land. But it's tribal. Legislation concerning nocturnal emissions and excrement in the camp. Because excrement and nocturnal emissions come from that kind of part of the body that's about life-giving, you know. So when death comes from that, and that's why women with menstruation is a problem for them too. Not a problem, but it's sacred. Because blood, which should have brought birth, life, has spilt. You get into their very primitive understanding of or misunderstanding of a lot of it. So therefore it was something sacred. So women who are menstruating weren't allowed in. And so similarly here, if all this happens, then something it does, magic, it does something wrong to the camp. There's legislation concerning escaped slaves. Slaves who have escaped to you from their owners shall not be given back to them. They shall reside with you in your midst in any place they choose, in any one of the towns, wherever they please. You shall not oppress them. That's pretty liberating and pretty problematic, but the slaves must have been treated terribly badly. Even though I've written a commentary on it, I can't remember what I wrote. Legislation governing prostitution. You can't take advantage of the poor by charging interest on a loan. And the church held to that for a long time, and then money changed its function, and so the law had to adapt to it. You must carry out your vows. There's legislation permitting picking of a neighbour's grapes or grain in chapter 23. There's a thing regulating divorce, which is important for the New Testament reasons, and I'll read it for you. It's chapter 24, the first verses, and this is how it reads in the book of Deuteronomy. Suppose a man enters into marriage with a woman, but she doesn't please him. Very male-oriented, as all the laws are. She doesn't please him because he finds something objectionable about her. Something objectionable. Edut dabar. There it is there. That's what the Hebrew says. At the time of Jesus, there were two opinions on this. Shammai, the older, leading interpreter of the law, said Edut dabar means sexual misconduct. Hillel, the more up-to-date, modern, liberal, said anything. If she cooks boiled eggs upside down and you just don't like it, well, get rid of her. I mean, bloke shouldn't have to put up with that at breakfast. Pretty well like it was anything at all that the man found objectionable. So there was an argument. Remember in the New Testament, they came up to Jesus and said to him, and they gave him these two alternatives. Can a man divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever? In other words, do you agree with Hillel? Or do you agree with Shammai? And he agreed with neither. But that's the New Testament, we're not into that now. But they were the two opinions that were argued about at the time. And unless you know that's being argued about, you can't understand the New Testament scripture. Well, here it says, this is the text, and so he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of the house. So he's got to write it. She then leaves his house and goes off to become another man's wife. Then, says this piece of legislation, suppose the second man dislikes her. She's still boiling eggs wrongly. He writes a bill of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or the second man who marries her dies. Gets such a fright, he dies. Her first husband who sent her away, this is the law, is not permitted to take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled. Another man has been with her. For that would be abhorrent to Yahweh, and you shall not bring guilt on the land that Yahweh your God is giving you as a possession. So at least it brought, it's primitive, and it's not going very far, but at least it gives her, if you're the woman and your husband divorces you, he can't at whim get you back. It has to be permanent. She's free. Free to find another partner and live a life. He can't have her on a string, you know, okay, so primitive, whatever, but that's the Torah. That's the law. And when they came up with Jesus, Jesus said, Moses wrote this for you. Because you were so bloomin' fickle, etc. But it wasn't like this from the beginning, and he goes on to do that. Here's another beautiful text now, and I'm nearly concluding. It's got three more pages. But we're getting now, at the end of this section, to the essential insights of the book of Deuteronomy, because we've been all over the place in a way. Chapter 24, 10 to 15 reads, when you make your neighbour a loan of any kind, you shall not go into the house to take the pledge. You shall wait outside while the person to whom you are making the loan brings the pledge out to you. If the person is poor, you shall not sleep in the garment given you as the pledge. You shall give the pledge back by sunset so that your neighbor may sleep in the cloak and bless you, and it will be to your credit before Yahweh your God. So I'm poor, I just need something, I need to buy some bread or something for my children, and I come to you and I give you my cloak, which is what I sleep in really, it's the warmth. So I give it to you as a pledge and say, look, I promise I'll pay you back. I'll be back, you know, when the bank opens at 3:30 or closes or whatever, I'll come back. But I don't come back. I just can't find it or anything. You have to come, you, the richer person, and give me my cloak back, and then say, well, look, I'll collect it again in the morning, but I do want my money back or whatever. But you can't keep it overnight. And you can't barge into my house and get back what you've lent me, because it's my home. It's a bit of protection, isn't it? And it's I think, obviously, it's good. Here's another. You shall not withhold the wages of the poor and needy labourers, whether other Israelites or aliens who reside in your land in one of your towns. You shall pay them their wages daily before sunset, because they're poor and their livelihood depends on them. Otherwise, they might cry out to Yahweh against you and you'd incur guilt. Another good piece of legislation to bring some protection to the poor. Chapter 24, verse 17, you shall not deprive the resident alien or an orphan of justice. You shall not take a widow's garment in pledge. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and Yahweh, God, your God, redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this. Who's that saint? There but for the grace of God go I. You know, you were a slave once, and God redeemed you, so you can't do this to other people. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field. Who painted that beautiful painting of the glaneurs? Millet. Thank you. Millet. He also wrote The Angelus. The Angelus painted that. He's got those women in the field, glaneurs, picking up their leftover wheat. So, thank you. When you reap your harvest in your field and you forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be left for the alien, the orphan, and the widow, so that Yahweh your God may bless you in all your undertakings. When you beat your olive trees, do not strip what is left. It shall be for the alien, the orphan, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, don't glean what is left. Don't go through a second time and get the rest of it. It shall be for the alien, the orphan, and the widow. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this. So, primitive but good legislation to start a process of helping the poor. And we conclude with a couple of things. He talks about a Levirate marriage. The Levir in Latin, it's a Latin term, means a husband's brother. So the 25:5-10 says, if your brother dies childless, you take his wife to you and have children with her for the brother. She wasn't asked, but that's what the blokes were told to do. However, this practice mentioned here in 25:5-10 of Deuteronomy was forbidden in Leviticus 18:16 and 20:21. So some of are forbidding it, some of are encouraging it. Where do you fit in? How do you work that all out? Now there's another little one on honesty in weights, chapter 25:13-16, that you don't muck up the weights. And finally, the Amalekites, this is how it all ends up, the Amalekites are to be wiped out. Victorians, scrap the lot of them. Including that ping pong, aerial ping pong that they play. Oh. That didn't go over too well. Did it? So, all right, okay, I'm sorry, I'm nearly finished. So, Amalekites are to be wiped out. Now, this wasn't relevant at the time of the Deuteronomists. Another example of reinforcing the need to not compromise their faith. The Amalekites, if there are any of them left, they were a kind of a Bedouin tribe. They've been incorporated into Judah centuries before all this. But they go back to the time of Moses, you know, when they stopped them getting in and kept them in the desert. So they're the kind of great enemies. So the giant at the top of the beanstalk, you've got to get rid of him. And that is, it's now your chance to get rid of me.